Good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see you all here. I'd have to say it's the best behaved audience I've ever seen. Everyone was sitting down when I arrived about 15 minutes early. So I hope I can continue to command your attention. So here is the subject, pricing tree structures with shifting parameters. This is based on a paper that will appear in Aston. The title of that paper is Evolutionary Hierarchical Credibility, but I thought you'd probably like this title or find it a little bit more user-friendly. But the technical title is Evolutionary Hierarchical Credibility, and I hope you'll see as I work through this why that title is appropriate. The usual acknowledgements. First of all, the main finance for this research came from the Institute, a grant made a shameful number of years ago, but finally coming to fruition. It also received some logistical support from the Australian Research Council through one of their funded projects. The usual disclaimer at the bottom of that slide. So here's the agenda. First, I want to talk about why we should be interested in this subject. And I should say it arose in two stages. I should be using this microphone, I gather. The first stage was nearly 40 years ago now, in the late 70s, and it was all to do with pricing workers' compensation. And the second stage has taken place, I guess, over the last 10 years, and the main motivation was once again pricing workers' compensation. I'll come to the details of that in a few moments. I'll establish the formal framework within which the model to be discussed is established. Talk about hierarchical models, first of all static, which are the ones from 40 years ago, and evolutionary, which are the more recent ones. Then take a small digression to talk about a thing called the Kalman filter, talk about it in general, and then how it relates to the present issue, and then provide a numerical example to attempt to demonstrate that this all works, and finally some concluding remarks. Okay, so the motivation. Let's start by considering what exactly is a hierarchy. Well, schematically, it looks like that. That's a little bit bare. Let me add some exemplary detail. First, just note that the points at which the lines in this figure make junctions are called nodes, and we'll use that terminology throughout. An example of this, and it was the original example in the motivation, is the ANZIC occupational coding. So it follows this kind of hierarchy, where at the first level downward, a node is labelled A. This is following the actual ANZIC coding. And then that A denotes agriculture, forestry and fishing collectively, a very big collection of employees. But it splits into a number of subsets, for example, A1, which is agriculture, A2, which is aquaculture, and then a whole lot of others which I don't have space for on this slide. And then the next main group is B, which is mining, and that too splits into subgroups as illustrated there. And again, there are a number of others not shown on that diagram. Now, there may be an observation made at each node, for example, claim frequency. If you're thinking of workers' compensation, it's clear that you can observe the claim frequency for the whole of agriculture, forestry and fisheries. You can observe the frequency for the whole of mining, and you can observe frequencies for each of the subgroups. So you may end up with this kind of situation where for industry as a whole, the whole of Australian industry, you might have, these are purely made up numbers I should say, a 7% claim frequency. But if you look at the agriculture subgroup, the frequency may be only 2.5%, balanced against 10% in the mining industry. And if you look at the subgroups, then you can observe frequencies there. So this is an example of the set of observations that one faces when wishing to carry out a pricing exercise, in this example, for workers' compensation. And to carry out that pricing exercise, one needs to estimate the frequency parameters that underlie these observations, because the observations themselves will contain a random disturbance which you wish to filter out to the greatest extent you can. Now, if the situation were just the one that I've illustrated there, we have the solution. One uses hierarchical credibility, and you can see by the references given there that the problem was solved just under 40 years ago. You can also see why the term hierarchical is used. The reason credibility is used is that a credibility type solution is applied, in which one gives only partial weight to the observations. So that's the explanation of the hierarchical credibility part of the title. I'll come to the evolutionary part shortly. Now, the situation that I've described is a static situation. You have a particular point in time, or perhaps a short interval over time, in which you make observations for which you suppose there are underlying parameters and you wish to estimate those parameters. But of course, life isn't static. Things change over time. These are the shifting parameters in my popularised title. And the statistical jargon for this is evolution. The parameters evolve over time. Hence the name evolutionary hierarchical credibility. We wish to consider not just the situation at a single point in time, but estimation over a number of periods of time. Okay, so we want to estimate the parameter. In my example, it was a claim frequency parameter at each node of the hierarchy and at each point of time, so let's say each year. So question is, how should we do this? One thing that you, and the thing that comes to mind first, but which you probably wouldn't want to do, is to treat each year's problem as a fresh problem. In other words, in 2016, you have a set of observations, you use the static hierarchical credibility to make estimates of your parameters. Now you come to 2017, you do a similar thing with a new set of observations. Now, that isn't very satisfactory, and the reason it isn't satisfactory is that you would suppose that the parameters that you're estimating would have limited variation over time. You would be slightly alarmed if you estimated a parameter in 2016 and then again in 2017 and you estimated it to be triple its previous year's value. You think, well, this may not be right, and it may have arisen simply because of the small samples of data that underlie it. So let's look at a formal framework for this. First, we need to venture just slightly into graph theory. Now, here's the definition of a graph. You may not feel like reading it, but maybe you can read it later on. But I've highlighted in red the essential features here, that a graph consists of a set of things called vertices or nodes. You saw the nodes already. And another set of things called edges. And then a third thing called an incidence matrix, which tells you how the edges relate to the nodes. So here is an example of a graph where I've numbered the nodes 1 through to 6. And the nodes are the circles, and you undoubtedly guessed the edges are the lines joining those circles. But of course, giving a list of nodes and a list of edges doesn't tell you enough to identify the graph, because you need to say, you can see here that not every node is joined to every other node. Any given node is only joined to particular ones. So you need a statement about which edges join which nodes. And that's where the incidence matrix plays a part. So here is the incidence matrix for that graph. And it's a very simple concept. For each edge, there is a column, and that column states which nodes are adjacent to the edges, or which nodes are joined by the edge. So, for example, if you look at the pictorial representation of the graph, you see that node 1 is joined to node 2 and node 3. And if you look at the matrix, and it's joined by edge 1, that's shown in the diagram. And if you look at the column for edge 1, you'll see that a 1 appears against nodes 1 and 2. So edge 1 joins nodes 1 and 2, and similarly for the others. There's another matrix that is routinely used in graph theory and called the adjacency matrix. It's kind of like the dual of the incidence matrix, in that for each node it indicates which nodes are adjacent. So for a given node, which nodes are joined to that node by an edge. So an example, first of all, the matrix itself. Let's take an example. Let's take node 1. It's adjacent to nodes 2 and 3 because there are edges that join node 1 to those. Now, if you look at the row for node 1 in the matrix, you see that there is a 1 against nodes 2 and 3. And you can read this either either rows or columns of this matrix because it's symmetric. And the reason I'm going into this is that the adjacency matrix is actually used later on in the model. Now, they're graphs in general. A tree, which will be the concern of this talk, is a special case of a graph in which if you take any two nodes, they're connected by exactly one path. Now, I'm not talking about an edge here. A path consists of a sequence of connected edges. I'll show you an example in a moment. So a tree is that special case. So going back to my original example, we call the top node of the tree the root. They're usually drawn upside down like this. Can you think of the root as at the bottom? But it's conventional to draw the diagrams vertically reversed. So the top node is called the root, and the bottom nodes are called the leaves. I guess the reason's obvious. And if you look at that, if you look at that graph or that tree, if you pick any two nodes on the tree, you'll find that they are connected by a single path. As I said before, the path can include more than one edge. For example, all the paths from the root to the leaves consist of two edges. So hierarchy means the same thing as a tree. And tree is a mathematical term. The actuarial term is more commonly a hierarchy, but it's the same thing. So the adjacency matrix for a tree, since a tree is a special case of a graph, the adjacency matrix for the tree is a special case of the adjacency matrix for a graph. So for the graph shown, there is the adjacency matrix for the entire graph, where you see that if you look at the row labelled A, you see that there is a 1 occurring under A1 and A2, indicating that that A is joined to A1 and A2 by an edge. And similarly, B is shown, the adjacency matrix shows B to be joined to B6, B7, and B8, but nothing else. Now, this is, you might say, well, wait there, A is actually connected to 0, and so is B. Why isn't that shown? Well, we're now talking about a directed graph, which means that there is a direction on each edge. So the direction in this case is always downward. You only ever go from... you only ever arrive at A from 0. You can't go from A back to zero. That's against the rules when it's a directed graph. So for a directed graph, the adjacency matrix appears as shown there. You see it's very special. You see that that row A and row B never have a 1 in common in the same column. And you see that all the leaves have rows of just zeros because they don't go anywhere. Okay, so we'll denote the graph. The hierarchy is H, and we'll denote its adjacency matrix by gamma of H. Now, you can extract the subgraph relating two levels of the entire graph. So we just need to pick out from the entire matrix the part that's relevant. So here I'm showing the subgraph that relates level 1, which is the level where A and B occur, to level 2, which is the level of all the leaves. And those submatrices are relevant later. And for notation, we'll just use H sub 2 to denote the sub-hierarchy that consists of just levels 1 and 2, and its graph, its adjacency matrix will be gamma of H2. Now, of course, I've used toy examples here because the real examples, if you actually look at the ANSYC codes, there are, I don't know how many, hundreds, if not into four figures of them, and I can't fit them on diagrams here. But they're our actual target. So we need to think in terms of larger trees than the ones that I've been illustrating. And we need a system for labelling the nodes of those large trees. So here it is. It's a bit nightmarish, I guess, but there isn't a way to avoid this. So the way that I've illustrated this is that I use I sub 0 to represent the root of the graph. And there's only ever one root, so I sub 0 is always 1 by definition. Now, the root branches to a number of other nodes, and they will be represented by I sub 0, 1, I sub 0, 2, and so on. And then a typical one of those, take I sub 0, 1, then branches further. And so its descendants are denoted I 0, I 1, 1, I 0, I 1, and in general I 2, and so on. And so if you arrive at the generic leaf at the very bottom, it's denoted by I 0, I 1, up to IQ. So this is a hierarchy with Q levels, a root and Q levels. And so by the time you arrive at the leaf, the label must consist of a number from each of the Q levels as well as the root. So that label indicates the path that has been taken from the root through the various levels to the leaf. Okay. So value. This is referred to as a queue hierarchy. And the nodes are labelled in the way I've set out there. At level M, labelled I0, I1 up to IM. Okay, so there are the trees with which we're working. Now, the next step is to associate a model with a tree. So we'll look at the static model first. So there is our tree. And now we associate a parameter vector, with each node of the tree. So if you want to think of a specific example, go back to my claim frequency example, and we're associating a claim frequency with each node of the tree. So it's a parameter vector of dimension one, but you can imagine that the parameter vector might be the claim frequency and the average claim size at each node, right? A vector of dimension two. So the notation for this is straightforward. If you label a node I0 up to IM, then label the associated parameter vector beta with a subscript equal to the node's label. And it'll be convenient sometimes to collect together all these frequencies. So if we want to take all the claim frequency parameters across level M, then we'll just write beta with a subscript M in brackets, denoting a vector of all those parameters, claim frequencies, if you want to stick with that example. And even it's even convenient sometimes to stack all of those vectors into a single vector beta. So beta then represents all of the parameters that have been associated with the tree. So that's notation. As to the model, here is the formal statement of the model. It's actually a simplified version of Sundt's 1980 model, because Sundt had some components in his model that are not required for what we're doing here. He had observations at every node of his tree rather than just at the leaves. So it's kind of interesting problem, not yet done by anyone, an interesting problem to extend that to an evolutionary form, but sufficient for now is the simplified version I'm using. So a parameter beta is associated with each node of the hierarchy. We've already had that. The parameter at the root of the tree is assumed fixed. If we look at at any level of the tree and we choose a parameter vector at any node on that particular level, that parameter vector is a random drawing from some distribution determined by its parent. Okay, so to put this in more specific terms, if you go back to my little toy example where I had at level one, I had one node representing agriculture, and within that I had aquaculture as a subnode. Then what we're saying here is that the claim frequency parameter for aquaculture is a random drawing from a distribution that is determined by the parameter of its parent. agriculture in general. Right? So we think of agriculture as all the occupations in agriculture combined form a set with a claim frequency. And then we think of all the subsets of that, like aquaculture, as having the parent's claim frequency, but with some random disturbance. Right? So this enables the frequency, the total of agriculture, to be spread into a variety of frequencies for its children. Okay, so we're very definitely... We're very definitely in the realm here of random parameters. It all starts at the root of the tree, and you may recall, don't have to recall. I've lost the full screen here. Okay. The parameter at the root of the tree is fixed. And then finally, at each of the hierarchy's leaves, there's a sample of observations. and that's drawn from some distribution determined by the parameter vector at its leaf. Again, to it.
When you say a random drawing, there's inherent differences in there. So is it just from a mathematical sense, or is it? I'm just trying to know what you mean by a random drawing in that context.
Okay, well, let me put it in terms of the example with which I've been working. Sorry, I'll go back here. I've been working with an example involving claim frequency. So when we get to a leaf of the tree, we have a parameter, a random parameter actually, but a parameter that represents the claim frequency at that leaf. We now have observations that have been drawn as a sample with that underlying claim frequency, but of course they will be randomly disturbed from the underlying frequency. So that's what I mean by drawn from a sample determined by beta at the leaf. Okay, so let's say the claim frequency is based on observations following a Poisson distribution. It's a Poisson distribution with parameter beta as at that leaf. Is that clear?
Yeah, happy, okay. Thank you.
Just follow-up question. So this, you mean that this is randomly drawn but then fixed? But from same as in the credibility environment, when you say a driver's parameter is randomly drawn from the population, but we can't observe it. But it was randomly drawn, but then fixed. It doesn't change over time. Is that the same framework?
We're dealing with a static model here, so yes, it's randomly drawn. At each node, the parameter is randomly drawn from a distribution determined by its parent's parameter. And then once it's drawn, it's fixed, yes.
Yeah.
We've got a parameter at each node of the tree, and we've got observations at the leaves. We've said that each each parameter, or the parameter at each node, depends on the parameter of the parent node, and that the observations depend on the parameter at the relevant leaf. Now this slide says how those dependencies are set out. So take the second dot point first. It's saying that the vector of observations across all the leaves is some linear function of the parameters across all the leaves, that's the beta q, plus a random term. So you can think of, if we're dealing with claim frequencies, you could think of each observation y being equal to its associated beta plus the random term, right? So you've got a beta representing expected claim frequency, you've got a y observation on claim frequency, y equals beta plus epsilon, right? It's that kind of thing. But here x might allow for more generality than that. Now, if you go back to the first dot point, that tells you exactly how each level of parameters relates to the previous level of parameters. So beta m, that's the vector of parameters across level m, is equal to the vector of parameters at level m minus 1 transformed by some linear operator w, and then with a random disturbance added. Again, you can think of the matrix W as containing ones, just ones and zeros, if you want to try to reduce this to a simple thought process, because you can think of any of the betas at level M being equal to its parent's beta plus a random disturbance, right? That's quite a respectable model. So again, the W just introduces more generality, but you can ignore it for the purpose of envisaging what's happening here. Okay, so X is just a typical regression design matrix, and the W that I've been talking about is called a transmission matrix because it transmits the effect of one parameter to its children's parameters. And we assume the random disturbance terms are centered, that is, have mean zero, and we give names to their covariance matrices. So the capital lambda represents the covariance matrix associated with all of the disturbances of the parameters, and H denotes the covariance matrix associated with all the disturbances to the observations. Okay, so that's the static model, and now we come to the evolutionary form of it. And you may think, oh no, that was bad enough, how much worse is this going to be? But in fact, it's actually very simple. So what I'll do is, in the next couple of slides, I'll basically repeat the slides that defined the static model, and wherever there's something different, I'll write it in brown. And you'll see there's not a lot of brown. So we've still got our Q hierarchy with parameters and observations. Now, this time we have to consider, instead of just considering the hierarchy as a fixed structure, we need to think of it as it progresses from one time point to another. So we're now looking at different times t. And the parameter vector we associate with a node now has a superscript on it, t, right? So it's exactly the same as before, except that we just recognize that it can change as we go from one time to another. I hope you can see that the t is in brown. Yes. And again, each parameter in the hierarchy is drawn randomly from a distribution determined by its parent. But once again, this varies according to t. And again, we take observations at the leaves of the hierarchy. But again, we take a sample of observations at each t. And again, we have a regression structure for the observations at the leaves, and everything's the same as before except labelled according to the time at which observations are being made. And here's the only tricky thing about the whole structure. The parameter vector evolves over time. So I've written the vector beta superscript t. So beta denotes, this denotes the whole ensemble of parameters at time t. And that evolves over time. And it evolves as follows. First of all, we define a new random variable. First of all, we define it at the root, and the new variable is denoted gamma, and at the root it's just equal to beta. We haven't done anything. But when we go to lower levels, gamma is defined as beta minus W beta. Beta M minus W times beta M minus 1. Now, before I go on and explain exactly what this means, it's clear that it's saying something about the relationship between levels M and M minus 1, right? Because the parameters at those two levels are involved in the expression. Now, here's how I think it's easiest to think of this. Let's get rid of the W. Let's regard that as just a nuisance for the time being. And we'll assume the W just consists of ones and zeros in such a way that every parameter beta at level M is equal to its parent at level, the parameter of its parent at level M minus 1 plus a random disturbance. I've used that example a few times already, right? So then the expression beta minus W times beta reduces just to beta at M minus beta at M minus 1. So what we're defining here is the disturbance that occurs between level M minus 1 and level M. Right? Think of that as there's a vector of disturbances across level M. And that vector of disturbances explains the extent to which the parameters at level M differ from the parameters of their parents. Now, just park that for a moment. Assume that the parameter at time zero is random with known mean and variance. Okay, so this is the initialization of our series of observations. We just assume that the initial parameters are known with known mean. are known with mean and variance. And then the parameters evolve in this way, that lambda at time t, we're working only at level m now, gamma at time t is equal to gamma at time t minus 1 plus a random disturbance. Now, we now have two sets of random disturbances. We have random disturbances that determine how parameters at level m relate to those at level m minus 1. And on the previous slide, I explained that or I gave an example of how we construct the vector gamma, which is the vector of those disturbances. And now we're saying that that vector of disturbances evolves through time according to another set of disturbances. Okay? So this is the hardest part, I think, to understand. I hope that explains it. Okay, and there we make some independence assumptions there that I won't linger over. Okay, now the original form of the model at the leaves looked as shown here. It's just a standard regression formula. We can make an alternative statement of it. The objective here is to convert it into a statement about the vector of disturbances gamma. And I won't give the working, but one arrives at this result, that the observation vector y is expressed again in linear regression form with parameter vector gamma, the one that I defined on the previous slides, and with a design matrix which is constructed out of the design matrix X for the original model and a whole lot of other matrices that I've shown there as W with a double subscript, and where those matrices are constructed from the adjacency matrices of the tree. Sorry, that what I said is true, but I haven't come to that yet. Constructed from the W's in the model of the tree. So everything is defined on the right hand side. We just have a different regression form now, but everything is defined in terms of the original structure. Okay, now that sets up our model. Let's now talk about the Kalman filter, and then I'll circle back to our original problem after that. So again, I'll give a slightly simplified form of the Kalman filter. If you look it up in standard textbooks, you'll find there's a bit more detail than I use, and one could introduce that additional detail. It doesn't make the exercise any more difficult. It just makes it a bit more obscure, so I haven't done it. So we're now working again with a time series, and we have an observation equation, so-called, or sometimes called a measurement equation, which takes the form shown there. It's typical regression equation. And we have a system equation, or sometimes called a transition equation, which tells you how parameters vary over time. And in this simplified form that I'm using, it's a very straightforward transition. It just says that the parameter vector at any time is equal to the parameter vector at the previous time plus a random disturbance. We assume that the initial parameter vector at time zero is random with known mean and variance. We assume that all of the random disturbances are normally distributed with zero mean and with the same naming convention for covariance matrices, that is matrix H for observation errors and matrix capital lambda for transition disturbances. Note the normality assumption. The Kármán filter is specifically applicable to cases of normal variables. I mean, it's a filter, so you can apply it to anything if you want, but its optimality problems arise out of normally distributed data. And now let's skip all working and just jump immediately to the algorithm representing the Kármán filter. Of course, its purpose is to make estimates of the parameters in this model. I'll show some algebraic expressions here, but you don't really need to follow them in detail for today's purpose, at least. The notation here is for time is of the form T bar S. You see it as superscripts there. And generally T bar S means we are making an estimate of something at time T using data up to time S, some earlier time S. So we let gamma with superscript T bar S mean the estimator of gamma super T, so the estimator of the parameter vector at time T, on the basis of data up to time S. And P denotes a covariance matrix. It's the covariance of the same quantity. Now, the Kármán filter operates by going from one point of time to the next. So it starts with estimates that have been made at one point of time, then it takes data and it updates those estimates to the next point of time. So we go through, it's recursive, we go through a cycle of operations at each stage. So suppose that we're now at time t and we have an estimate of gamma based on data up to time t minus 1. Okay, so we've just arrived at time t and we're looking back at the estimate that we previously made on data up to time t minus 1. And we have the associated covariance matrix as well. Well, now we calculate a matrix called F. And you can see that it's based on quantities that are already known. U and H are defined within the model, and P is our previous estimate of the covariance matrix. Then we use that to calculate another matrix called the Kármán gain matrix. Right? So it's just straightforward calculations. And then we update the matrix P, T bar, T minus 1 as follows. We now calculate the matrix at time T plus 1 based on data up to time T according to that formula. And then we update the estimate of our parameter vector gamma according to that formula. And what you see about that formula is that the estimate of gamma at time t based on data to time t is equal to the previous estimate of the same thing plus something involving the bracketed term y minus u times y. So y is our latest observation, so it's a new data, and the other part, u times y, is the quantity we would have forecast for the current period based on previous data. So the bracketed term is the difference between what the observation we actually made and what we expected. So, and it's multiplied by k. So k downweights it, in other words. So in words, the current estimate is equal to the previous estimate plus some fraction of the difference that we observe between the previous estimate and the latest data, right? That's typical credibility formula and intuitively, and it's intuitive. And then we can update further in this simple way. So this is the credibility type estimator, the Kalman filter. Okay, so now applying that, we come back now and apply it to our situation with our tree. There is a restatement of the model that we established for our tree with evolving parameters. There is a statement of the Kalman filter. And you can see that they're of identical forms, so the Kalman filter can be applied to our situation. So this is our estimation procedure for our tree with evolving parameters. We just formulate the Kalman filter to apply to it. And so we get an estimate of parameter vector gamma at each point of time, but gamma is uniquely related to beta, so we can reverse out an estimate of beta as well. Okay, a numerical example. So in this case, I'm now going to set up a tree. It's a different one from the one I've given in previous examples. So at level zero, as usual, we have the single node denoted one. At level one, we have three nodes. And at level two, we have, what's that one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten nodes. So you see that node 1, 1 splits. Yeah, well, let me give you the diagram of it. So there's the tree. So the root splits into three nodes. Node 1, 1 splits into two. Nodes 1, 2, and 1, 3 each split into four. The vector y represents claim frequencies per unit exposure observed at the leaves. And here is the model structure. I'm going to choose the simplest form of model out of the general model that I've given. The observations at the leaves are just a linear function of the parameters at the leaves plus a disturbance term. The expectation of any parameter in the hierarchy is equal to the parameter of its parent. I've given that example a number of times previously. The matrix W, the transmission matrix W, is equal to the transpose of one of the subsets of the adjacency matrix of the graph. That was the relevance of those adjacency matrices. And that is the translation of the expectation statement that follows it. The variance of observations, variance is beta divided by exposure E, so this is consistent with a Poisson distribution. We assume the covariance matrices in the body of the tree are diagonal, so everything's about as simple as you can make it. Here are the initial values, so these are the values at time zero, where I've given the mean and variance of the initial parameters. Remember, the initial parameters were random with known mean and variance, so there they are. And I give the parameter variance capital lambda. So this is the variance of the disturbances at each node. And here are the observations. Now these observations have been simulated. So I've taken I've associated parameters, underlying parameters, with all the nodes of the tree, and I'll explain how I've done that in just a moment. And then I've simulated Poisson distribution at each node according to the exposure shown there. And there are the in columns 1, 2, 3, there are the simulated claim frequencies per exposure. Now, on the previous slide, I gave the initial expectations for all the nodes, so the expectations at time zero. I assume that all nodes are trendless except a few, so that means the expectation remains constant over times 0, 1, 2, 3 at all nodes except the ones that I'm going to name. So node, and they're the ones shaded in the table. Node 1, 2, 1 is the underlying, the sort of the hidden parameter that we're attempting to estimate, is subject to an upward trend of 0.015 per period. Node 1, 2, 4 is flat, but there's a reduction of 0.040 made immediately between time 0 and time 1. And node 1, 3, 2 shows a downward trend of 0.020 per period. Okay, and here are the results if one just applies the Kalman filter in the way that I've described. I'll just go back and note one point here. If you look at these exceptional nodes, for example, node 1, you see the observations go 62, 94, 97. Now, the underlying trend is upwards. So those observations are consistent with with that upward trend, but of course they don't follow it exactly because of the randomness in them. Likewise, node 1, 2, 4 is flat across times 1, 2, and 3, but you see there's quite a bit of variation in the observations there. So you can't get the answers here just by looking at these numbers. You need more of a procedure. So here's what we get. In the plot, the yellowish line represents the 3 years observations. This is for node 121. The initial value is shown at the left end of the blue line, so 0.05. And then the blue line traces through subsequent times the estimates from the Kalman filter. So this 121 was a case in which the true frequency, the true but unknown frequency, was increasing. And you see that the blue line does increase. The dotted lines show one standard deviation above or below the estimate. So you see that two out of three of the observations lie within that envelope. One of them doesn't, but there's no drama in that. It's only one standard deviation. Node 124, now this was the one that started at a frequency of 0.12 and dropped immediately to 0.08 and remained there. And you see that the estimates in the blue line do show that decrease, or show a decrease. And in fact, that they happen to track the data fairly closely. I think that's from memory. I think that's because there was a fairly high exposure at that node. But they will never track the observations exactly, because bear in mind that estimates at node 124 are affected by what happens at nodes 123 and 122, right? Because they all have the same parent. And node 132, which was one with a slowish decreasing trend, does show that the estimates decrease over time, but not as sharply as the observations do. And that's to be expected because you're using a credibility type of estimator that gives less than full weight to observations. Okay, so just concluding comments. An evolutionary hierarchical model was formulated. The parameter estimates were obtained by application of the Kalman filter. That filter updates estimates from one time to the next as further data are observed. The application of the filter is conceptually straightforward. This was all done in Excel, actually, so it's quite simple. Of course, if you're using a larger tree, you wouldn't want to do it in Excel, but it's straightforward. It's really just once you formulate the model with a defined matrices and vectors, it's just a matter of carrying out operations. There's nothing much to think about. Of course, the tree structure can be extensive, and there's some effort required in the accounting for all the nodes and the incorporation of them in the model. But this is achieved. It's not really shown by my toy examples, but this is simplified by the use of the adjacency matrix associated with the tree. That does your bookwork for you, in effect. And the adjacency matrix is then used in the Kalman filter calculations. So there are the references that I made. And we're through. Questions?
Yep. Sorry, actually, it's a quick one on page 23 of your slide.
Yes. Oh, thanks. Yeah. So we noticed that the transformation matrix has been made time homogeneous across total time. So I was just wondering what's the rationale behind that.
Right, let me see.
Yeah, page 23. Yeah, so if you look at the bottom for past it.
Do that.
Yeah. So for W at M-1, we understand it's not varying across time, so which means the structure of the hierarchy can't change across time.
That's
so
right.
Say for example at time t we have like n products, at time t plus 1 I actually have n plus 1 products. So how does the model actually allow for the added product or minus a product, stuff like that?
What do you mean by products?
Oh, sorry, it's just that I think in terms of how many, you know, the number of leaves at a certain level. At time
okay.
t, we have like 10 leaves, time okay. t plus 1, 11,
right.
something like that. Yeah.
So I guess one simple way of doing this, but without needing to change the algebra anywhere, is that if you're considering the case, I take it, where some leaf vanishes and another one appears.
Yeah.
So define the union of all the trees involved at the different points of time, so that all leaves that ever appear in that union of trees.
Okay.
And then put null observations where required.
So like at a certain point in time, so the number of trees is just nothing but a subset of the entire portfolio you construct.
And then you have if you include a node,
mm-hmm.
or include a leaf, let's say,
mm-hmm.
That really isn't there for that point of time, just put zero exposures at it, and then it has no effect.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you need to change the algebra. I haven't done it, but I don't think it would be difficult. I think you just need to, as you say, the definition here is one in which the structure remains constant, but I think if you just reformulate the model with a different structure at each point of time,
right, that just requires a re-estimation at a certain point of parameters at a certain point in time then.
I'm saying all this, but I'm having doubts about one point, and that is when a leaf suddenly appears. I guess it works. I mean, it appears that it has a defined parent, so it can take its value from that parent.
I think
that's an answer anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. But the only thing might change is the parent volatility a little bit, because you have like, you know, more diversification of his children, like you have more leaves over there. There could be a different change. No, just making it up. But
okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
This applies to, or it doesn't matter?
I stated the constraint in that the Kalman filter applies to normal distributions. Now, as with all filters, you can apply them to what you like, but they'll do something, but they lose their optimality problem, or the Kalman filter loses its optimality properties as you move away from normal distributions. That's not going to be a big deal if your true distributions are something like normal. And you're probably going to ask me what I mean by that. When you start talking about how non-normal a distribution is, you're getting into vague territory. But I guess my guesswork is that as long as you use something, a distribution that is from the exponential family, so in other words, it has a tail that declines to zero exponentially, and it doesn't have a particularly large coefficient of variation, this probably isn't a big deal. But if you're going to start working with Pareto distributions or other long-tail distributions, then I think I'd become desperately unhappy about the Kalman filter and what it might do.
If I may just, I also think that there's a question of how many observations you have, because of the central limit theorem. When you have a lot of them, they start looking normal, and then the Kalman filter is doing well. if you have a low frequency framework, then Kalman is not going to do very well. Would you agree?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, but I mean, one of the protections that you have from credibility theory is that it has that very intuitive form of updating a previous estimate by a fraction of the difference between that estimate and your next observation, and it's difficult to go too far wrong with that. And you're going to get something sensible. At least you will, if the example is as simple as I just stated. In the case of a very big tree, you're not quite doing that because you're not multiplying that difference between observation and expectation by a constant between 0 and 1. You're multiplying a vector of those things by matrix, and it's not clear what is going to come out of that. So it may all be okay with a big tree. I don't know. I'd want to look at that. But, you know, I mean, my point is that credibility theory by its nature is something that is relatively robust.
So can you tackle by pruning your tree back to a level where all the leaves are significant?
You certainly, well, you don't even need to prune because those estimates come out of the algorithm. But again, the way that credibility works is that if the exposures are very small, then there's very little weight given to those observations, and so if you can go back to a level of the tree where sample sizes are big enough that you're confident. Now, if you look to the next level, and you look, let's say one of the nodes at the next level has a very small exposure, what that means is that it's going to take on its parent's estimate with some variation from the algorithm, but the variation is going to be small.
You know how you take into three examples where you have underlying trend, but what have you looked at ones where you don't expect any trend and whether you see any upward extreme movements up and down throughout the years, and it's kind of taking similar to that example. If you have low exposure, would you expect this methodology to have a lot of extreme movement throughout years?
No, and for the reason I just gave, that when the exposure is low, the correction to the parent's parameter is small. So where exposure is low, you get very small variation over time. And in fact, that's one of the problems when you apply this in practice. One of the areas where I've applied this has been in a state's workers' compensation scheme, not with the ANZIC coding, but with where the state has like government agencies, and the agencies have cost centres and sub centres and so on. And you apply it to them, and you get down to cost sub-centres that might have one claim on average every 8 years or something like that, virtually no data, and that almost guarantees that their estimate is not going to shift much over time. And it's a problem because then they say, but yes, but in the last year we did this and we did that, and then our claim frequency should be lower, and you're not recognising it, right? But you can't because there's no experience, and the frequency estimate almost doesn't change over time.
So you've used a defined tree, right? But what if you don't know what the tree, the optimal tree factor is, structure is?
Sorry, you don't want what?
If you don't know what the tree structure is. So say you've got male, female, and then occupation codes. What if you split it so that you have occupation codes and male, female?
I don't know. I mean, this is, if I understand you correctly, this is a practical problem as well. Because sometimes you present the ANZIC coding system to someone and they say, well, we don't believe it. We don't think that this particular node belongs under this parent. It belongs over there. And how you settle that is another question entirely. So I guess my response is, if you're not sure about the tree structure, then you've got a whole new game to start with, in that you now have to think up a test. Let's say there's only one node in question. You need to set up a test as to whether that node belongs where it's been placed. if the evidence might say that, you know, there's no evidence against it, it's okay, finished, or no, it doesn't belong there, and then you have to decide where it does belong. This is a whole exercise in itself, but I'm beginning from the point where you've settled the tree.
Yeah, sure.
Can you have leaves that can come from two parents, so it converges?
Not in a tree.
Not in a tree.
You can in a graph, but not in a tree. A tree, by definition, can't do that.
But let's say, go back to that state sample you said, where you have sub-cost centers.
Yeah.
Practically, you can't have one sub-cost center servicing two parties.
You could, if you've got some kind of matrix structure in the organisation, that could happen. I haven't encountered it myself, and I'm not addressing it here.
But okay.
Yeah, again, you're into a different problem. You'd have to, what I'm talking about here wouldn't fit that case. You'd have to redefine the problem. Okay, well, no more questions. Well, thanks everyone for coming along.